Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Life is Short ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Most kids dream at one point in their lives about being a rock star. I think, right? That's a common fantasy.
Yeah, I would say.
Did you have that fantasy?
Well, I got to sort of live out that fantasy a little bit.
You did? Oh, that's right, in your band at Colgate, yeah. In your a cappella band. I did once get to do a version of that. There's a scene in Accepted where I get up on stage and I sing the Ramones song, Blitzkrieg Bop.
I'm not going to sing it now.
But I practiced it. I have terrible rhythm, but I learned the rhythm. I got it all down. And I really got into it. And I was like, oh my God, I'm awesome at this. I'm really like, I could do this. I finished the song and the audience was into it. And then the band was like, hey man. And then I got a little like lightheaded. And then my knees started to kind of shake and give way. And I had to like sit down and be taken care of by the hair and makeup ladies because I was having a little bit of a heat stroke. They brought me Pedialyte with a straw in front of everyone.
I wonder if a roadie in the Ramones ever had to bring Joey Ramone a Pedialyte with a straw.
That's one song, I know.
They're rolling over in their graves right now.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-boom. You're listening to Life is Short. I'm your host, Justin Long.
Life could be a dream, sweetheart. Do, 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 shaboom.
And with me, as always, is another co-star in Accepted, Christian Long.
Yes. I had a slightly smaller part than you, but I was, I would say, as important.
There are no small true. Parts, only small actors.
Shit sandwiches.
Yeah. You weren't there that day, were
no.
you?
No.
It was a moment that, like... If ever I thought – it was also funny because I had had this surge of confidence. So I was like – so the it was like a real 180, you know.
Well, I think life is about those moments. You know, it's like everyone thinks they can do something until they can't. And,
right.
you know, it's
That's
like
true.
You tried to be a football player when you were in ninth grade.
Yeah.
And then you realize you couldn't.
What,
and you weren't cut out for that.
Have you tried to do stuff that you
– No. I've pretty much just succeeded in anything I've tried.
So you're the exception.
Yeah. But most people, they experience failure after failure. And
God, that's right. You've never – yeah.
No. I mean I did the music thing. I did the – you know.
The music thing. Yeah. It was a really
– I got out of the music thing a few years ago.
Why did you?
I don't know. I graduated from college and I just figured.
Your band, you disbanded. They kind of went their separate ways.
We did.
Did you think about doing a solo career as a bass, a cappella bassist?
Bum, 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 bum.
Yes. But that'd be funny. A solo bass version of Mr. Sandman.
That would be funny.
Bum, 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 bum. Yes.
Bring me a drink.
And just like silence for a while. So anyway, why are we talking about my one failed attempt at being a rock star? Our guest today actually played very convincingly, much more convincingly than I did in Accepted. He played a rock star in the movie Almost Famous. Our guest today is one of my favorite actors, one of my favorite people, Billy
Crudup. Not Crudup,
no.
As Justin told me years ago. It was you insisted.
No, that's
it was
not
Billy
true.
Crudup a long time
it's
ago.
It's not true. For a long time, I didn't really know definitively, and I've known Billy. We talk about this. I don't want to spoil anything, but we talk about his name, his last name. People are like, and for years I'd been doing it myself, Crudup. And I'd asked him too in the past, and it just didn't stick for some reason. But anyway, oh, don't worry, we'll get into how
deep,
to pronounce his
deep
name.
Deep into
yeah.
that.
He's just one of. He's always been one of my favorite actors. When I first started out, he was one of those guys that he was just breaking. He was like the it guy, and I really looked up to him. I saw him once in one of the best things I've ever seen on stage was his production of or his portrayal of the Elephant Man. He did it with no prosthetics. Bradley Cooper did another great performance.
I saw that.
You did.
Mm-hmm.
And Bradley didn't have prosthetics, did he?
No.
Nor did Billy. And they're both obviously very like handsome men. And they you forget it within
very handsome.
Okay, calm down. Who would you say is more handsome?
Billy.
Yeah, I think so too. Although Brad, I mean, it's hard to how do you?
Well, Bradley's so much taller and has that like.
I love what you just did. Christian just did a motion with his hands like he was filling out his pecs.
Well, he's bigger.
Bigger. Yeah.
He's so
brawny.
Yeah, he's like the brawny
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Whereas Billy is a lot smaller.
Yeah, but
such a handsome face.
Such a, I know. Okay. He's got such great, like, features and bone structure. But that's why I was surprised to learn that he wasn't as tall as I thought he was.
I mean, Me too. I remember meeting him for the first time and thinking, that's so strange that he's not taller.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has such a big presence.
Well, same
on
thing
screen.
With Tom Cruise. You've
no,
never
I've
gotten
never
to
met
meet
him.
Yeah.
No.
Uh-huh. I did. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I was, he was so charming, but also like, whoa. And I had been a little bit more prepared for Tom Cruise because I'd heard about, you know, that mm-hmm. he wasn't that tall. And but Billy, I know that Billy came up to me when I was a young actor. I was 23, 24. I was up at theater festival in Williamstown. I'd just seen Sam Rockwell do another one of the other great things I'd seen on stage. He did a production of Zoo Story with Jelko Ivanek. And Billy came up to me, and I was like, oh. And I knew that Bill. I was aware of Billy's presence because I'd seen him kind of milling around. And, of course, I knew who he was, and I was such a fan. And he came up to me and he said, hey, man, I don't want to – I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to say I really loved you in Galaxy Quest. And he paid me like the most heartfelt – and I was almost speechless. I was so struck by it. I was so thrown by it. It was like easily
– That's a good – not all compliments are created equally.
Oh, God, I know.
That's a good
best.
One.
It was one of the best. To this day, I mean, I never forgot that. And then I got to know him, and it meant nothing to me then at that point. I continued to really admire him. You should – we talk a lot about his new show on Apple TV. It's called
– The Morning Show.
Yeah. Why did I space on that? It's really good, and Billy is – great.
It's the season finale is a couple days from now December 20th.
Check it out.
The show is, I think, quite good, and I think he is excellent in it. He's getting great reviews.
Mm-hmm.
He's also a Tony Award winning actor. He's multiple Tony nominations, great theater actor, great movie actor. He's been some great big movies, The Watchmen, Mission Impossible 3.
You know what I wish I – oh, we'll get
the latest Alien movie. He's –
That's right.
He does it all.
And for context, because we do talk a lot about this, and I realize we don't really give context to it in the interview, his big start came when he was cast in a play called Arcadia. Tom Stoppard, one of the great living playwrights, British playwright, is had written Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which was a huge hit. And this is maybe his biggest play, or certainly one of them. And Billy was cast right out of acting school in the lead role. And that's how he kind of came to prominence, and he started getting cast in all these movies. But just to contextualize it, Arcadia is a – and it's a very dense – like Tom Stoppard's other plays, it's very dense, and he's a real – I mean, he's like a – what would you say? His craftsman of words. I mean, he's
– Tom Stoppard?
Yeah.
He is a craftsman of words.
Yeah. And Billy was able to – he was received incredible reviews and was able to handle that sophisticated dialogue in such a deft, easy way. And again, like, not to dwell on it, but then you look at him and he's gorgeous.
Get off his looks.
I can't. Yeah, you can't hear that in the interview, but
– You can't hear his beauty.
No. Well, maybe you can. Maybe that's how beautiful he is. Anyway, he's just – I love him. I've just so happy I got to sit down with him because there were so many things that I had not occasion to ask him as a friend, as like a, just seeing him socially. It'd be embarrassing to ask him those questions at like a party or at a dinner with people. Anyway, you'll hear my exuberance, I think, is pretty clear because he's just one of my favorite people. My conversation with my pal – Billy Crudup, coming up next.
Crudup. Used to have an umlaut.
Coming
over the
oop next.
Life could be a dream, sweetheart. Do, 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 shaboom.
For all the shorties that want voluminous, fanned-out lashes, mm-hmm. this ad is for you. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara creates corner-to-corner panoramic lash volume. Their tapered brush catches every single lash, even those pesky corner lashes. You know who you are, corner lashes. With the Panorama Mascara, you'll easily achieve that effortless, false lashes look. It's one of Christian's favorite looks. Plus, it lasts up to 24 hours and is clump and flake resistant. And just when you thought it couldn't get better, it does. The Panorama Mascara is a lot more affordable than other luxe mascaras.
And honestly, it probably does a better job. It's affordable, but it's deceptive because it comes in a premium gold luxe packaging. So if you want a mascara that can do it all, volumize, lengthen, and stay put all day, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Hello, hello again. Shaboom and up, we'll meet again.
You saw the Jackson 5 in concert?
Yeah.
I can't believe you're using a handkerchief.
I'm old. I saw the Jackson 5. I'm using a hanky.
You got a backwards cap. That's
I'm 87.
Cool. Now it looks like you're trying to look young.
That's for the youth.
My Christian, my brother and I were just talking about a handkerchief. Our dad had one growing up when we were growing
up. That's why I carry. My dad carried one, and yeah. I started it as a habit. And when I had my son Will, it just becomes the most useful thing when there's like, you know, a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
Come here, man. Get it, Gary.
That's true. My brother just had a kid today, and I'm going to get
what?
Him.
What?
Yeah, his second kid.
Congratulations.
It's exciting. But I'm going to get him a hanky. I'm going to get him a monogrammed hanky.
That's fantastic.
And he'll think it's a joke, and he'll probably end up using it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was very close to my grandfather. He also carried a hanky. He and I had lunch every day for 4.5 years while I was in college.
No
he was
shit.
He was a recent widower. My grandmother died my graduation day from high school.
Wait, so this is when you were in Chapel Hill?
Chapel Hill, exactly.
Oh, wow.
So I was living in South Florida at the time. My grandmother passed away, and they lived in Henderson, North Carolina, which is about 40-45 minutes from Chapel
yes,
Hill.
I've been there. I worked there.
Through Durham? What? You're thinking of Hendersonville near Asheville?
Oh, Asheville.
Right,
oh, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Oh, no, never mind. Okay.
Yeah, because nobody has been to Henderson unless you've worked in at the yarn mill there. It's a small town.
Yeah.
And when I went to go to school at Chapel Hill, my grandfather was 45 minutes away. And so we started to have lunch every week.
He
went to Chapel Hill. My dad went to Chapel Hill.
Wow.
And there was a restaurant there called the Ratskeller that was there when my grandfather was there. So we would eat there.
That's so cool.
Every Tuesday
so
or Thursday.
For him.
It was.
He must have loved that.
I mean, it must have been incredible for him to have my company. You're right.
No, well,
it's kind of like you right now.
This, well, that's how
now
I feel.
You get to feel what my grandfather. But he was like he was a super tough dude.
Yeah. So he wouldn't express.
No.
That.
No.
Yeah.
Like every.
Like, what form would that
take?
A couple
of years, he would get drunk enough at night to be, hey, you're doing a pretty good job.
Aww,
you know, like, mostly it was like, oh, what are you screwing up now, Bill?
But there was love behind it.
Listen, it was the way I knew how to relate to him. It didn't intimidate me, you know. It was the only way that he knew how to communicate. Like, as far as I was concerned, the fact that he showed up every week was his expression of love.
Totally,
And,
oh, my God.
So we became—
And 45 minutes away.
And 45 minutes away. And he did the drive, and, you know, he was there for me every time sort of the bottom would fall out, and I wouldn't be able to make up enough money for the tuition or, you know, I needed money for rent. So we had a really tight relationship. Well, to the point, and this is back to the handkerchief story. He always carried a handkerchief. He passed away in 98.
So you were in college in like early 90s.
I finished school in 91 at Chapel Hill. Then I went to NYU until 94. And then my grandfather passed away, I think, around 96.
So was he able to see you in movies or in Arcadia?
He was not able to see Arcadia. My other grandparents were, my grandmother Mimi is still alive. She's 95, 96, lives in South Florida. Amazing person.
Where in South Florida?
She's in Coral Gables.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And she was married to a bishop, Bishop Duncan.
What?
He was a bishop in the Episcopalian Church, the South Diocese, South Florida Diocese. And the two of them came up to see Arcadia. So they did get to see it. But he was alive long enough to see me have the beginning of my career.
Yeah.
And
he saw the direction that it was probably.
He saw that I was working, which was a huge, like, he worked at a yarn mill.
But wait, sorry, Billy. Was he like an actor? Was it like, are you kidding?
Oh, yeah. Like, wouldn't say the word, you know? Like,
I was like.
And when I was at, Chapel Hill, I wasn't a theater major. It was all cloak and dagger for me because these guys were paying for my education. Which, when
just
I think
don't do
back
none
of
that fruity acting,
yeah,
that's the one stipulation.
Because if I gotta see any of that, I'll lose it, and then I'll take you down with me.
Unless Charlie Bronson's in it.
Then I, well, it's true. That is the kind of, like, James Cagney, you know, if you're going to be one of those tough guys.
Yeah.
But I was always the sensitive dude, so I was definitely not going to be in one of those. But he would come and see my plays, these avant-garde plays, and sit there with his arms crossed, and then afterwards say, I don't know what the hell that was all about, but good job.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so when he passed away, my older brother Tommy.
It's funny and moving.
It was a beautiful thing for me to have that relationship and to have that support. As difficult as he was at times.
No, but when you know somebody and you know where it's coming
well,
from.
Well, that's it. Yeah. You for me it was very clear.
Yeah.
And that was not the case for my dad. They had a very contentious relationship, know. And
maybe he felt like some of the mistakes he made with your dad, he's making up.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my dad felt that, and you know, he was resentful of that in me, that I got to spend so much time with him.
Weird.
So it was a really wild dynamic.
And what's your dad do?
He was a hustler, really. I mean,
like a prostitute?
He started businesses, supposedly. But he was also a bookie and a loan shark and a con man.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was a pretty wild figure.
What is he still?
No, he passed away in 2005. He was 63 and looked, you know, about 100. He lived hard.
Oh, my God.
He lived hard.
Is that why you traveled around so much as a kid?
Yeah. My parents, my dad was unpredictable. Charming, incredible, like a great salesman, gorgeous guy. I mean, loved people too. Like, could be fascinated by anyone.
Wow.
Typically, though, those conversations.
You're a very curious person.
I am. That's it. As soon as you said that, I shut down.
Yeah, no, there's nowhere to go.
I'm not so curious anymore.
You can't say yes, I am, because then it seems like douchey and braggy. You can't say no, because it's not the truth.
Well, I do, the expression for my curiosity typically comes in the form of my acting, where trying to figure out a character is endlessly fascinating to me. But I have much more social anxiety than my dad. My dad could walk into any party, any block in Manhattan, and anywhere in the country. Really, he was that capable.
Fuck, I wish
and win the room, you know.
I mean, he cornered
Tom Cruise at the premiere of Without Limits.
Uh-huh.
He says to me,
because Tom Cruise produced that.
Tom Cruise produced it, and it was at the Toronto Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad says to me in typical fashion, Disky, you going to have a premiere for the Without Limits? And I said, well, it's actually going to a film festival in Toronto. And in my head, I'm thinking, I do not want my dad there, like under any circumstances.
Was he like a social liability?
He was a liability insofar as his curiosity would ingratiate people. And the end of the conversation was typically, would you be interested in investing in a product I'm very excited about, Coffee Elite? It's an additive to coffee that we are at the moment selling to institutions. And needless to say, the person would start backing
Tom
away.
Tom Cruise is in a pyramid scheme all of a sudden.
So, well,
or another one.
Tom Cruise was cornered. So I took my dad said, so you're going to be the premiere, and I said, well, it's going to be going to a film festival in Toronto. Huh. And when is that happening? I think it's, you know, sometime around September
and
or so.
Where's he now?
He's in Dallas.
Okay.
Or he was at Austin, actually, at this point.
Okay, that makes
and
sense.
He says, well, I might just have some business up in Toronto.
Oh, man.
And I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. But I'm just sitting there on my, you know, phone going, okay, probably my StarTAC flip phone, holding it away from my ear going, what do I do about this?
And what do you do? You can't
do anything. I was like, all right, Dad, well, if you're up there. And, you know, most of the stuff that that he would say he was going to do, he didn't end up doing.
Yeah.
It's not that he didn't want to. It's just that he didn't really have the agency or the follow through. Yeah, because, you know, he was like a cat. All of a sudden, he would be excited about something else in the other room, and he's got to go there.
He's just in the moment.
He's in the moment.
I've known a lot of actors like that.
Fascinating, you know.
They did like a lot of them.
Personality.
Yeah.
I think most of them.
Yeah.
Isn't that correct? So he shows up to the Toronto Film Festival, as a matter. And at the after party.
Does he contact you before? Do you have any awareness that he's going to be there besides that conversation?
Maybe 3 days before, you know. And
not enough to warn Tom Cruise.
Not enough to warn Toronto and Canada. I mean, and essentially what I realize is he's going up there to buy some Cuban cigars to smuggle back to the States.
Sure.
I mean,
it is business.
It was always business.
Yeah.
But I turned my back for 5 seconds at the party, and he's got Tom Cruise cornered and is giving him a lecture about parenting.
Oh, no.
So that was pretty fascinating. And Tom seemed totally interested.
Yeah.
So
he may have given him some good tips. I don't know.
Could have.
Yeah.
Could have. Ones that he hadn't used himself.
Yeah.
And had maybe discovered once his children were grown.
Yeah. Whoa. Wow. So how do you navigate a situation like that? Do you say it is your dad, so you can't be like disrespectful, and but it's also Tom Cruise, it's kind of your boss?
Yeah, I had it's confusing, as you might imagine. You just put it perfectly. It's like I'm sitting there staring at, like, already I'm in over my head. I'm starring in a movie that is directed by Robert Towne, shot by Connie Hall, with Donald Sutherland and Tom Cruise and Paula Wagner producing. Like, I'm way over my head.
I know Robert Towne directed that.
He wrote and directed
no
it.
No kidding.
Well, you know, he did Personal Best as well, and he was fascinated with running as a metaphor.
Huh.
And Steve Prefontaine was this really wild figure in the early 70s. And
that was the year there were two Prefontaine movies.
Well, it turns out that those guys were working together at first.
Oh.
And there was a creative difference or whatever. And so both movies were sort of sidelined. And then as soon as one of them got going, it literally became a race.
That's funny.
I know. And I arrived in
that's so funny.
Where were we? In Oregon, where we shot some of the exteriors at the field where Pre ran as well, at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And I'm kind of wandering around the stadium, seeing like kids still in Stop Pre T-shirts and stuff.
Oh,
and I'm like amazed by it all.
Yeah.
And one of the people working on the production said, "So don't worry about the other production. We're going to get out ahead of it." And I was like, "The other production?
Oh, you know,
nope,
Michael.
No idea." No idea.
Jared, who now?
Yes, he's done extremely, extremely well.
Leto played the other one. Whoa, what do you think at that point?
Well, at that time, you think, well, the entertainment business is an interesting business. nobody told me about this. And so there was this competition to get one of the movies out first. But, you know, actually that... It's funny because that one of the reasons I was probably involved with that movie in particular was because I can remember the Sports Illustrated with Prefontaine on the cover. I think it was 1972 or something like that. And I must have been 4 years old or, you know, almost five. And but my dad was a sports fanatic. Well, in no small part because he was a gambler and a bookie.
Uh-huh.
so it was his trade.
Right.
But I can remember this haunting portrait.
Was that the one where he just of him in action?
It was the one of his face.
Yeah.
A close up portrait. And that association with my own history with my dad and my grandfather and feeling like acting was an emasculating legacy for my family.
Yeah.
This was an opportunity for me then to get them on my
side,
you know.
Oh,
and
my God.
So
your dad even harbored those feelings too.
No question about it. They just didn't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, ironically, my dad had modeled because, like I said, he was a hustler. There was like a famous story in the family that he auditioned for.
Billy something, is struggling. Your it's face to do is with, a Twitter.
It's something to do with San Francisco that the part eventually went to Michael Douglas. It was a TV show about San Francisco. San Francisco.
Armistead Mopan's Tales of the City.
I'm sure it probably came out it. Because I can remember between my mom, who was like the champion of all of it for keeping us together. I had two brothers. Uh-huh. And she was the, you know, like stable force through all of it. And obviously got my dad's charm. Like yeah. she loved that part of my dad, but also knew very well that he was not so capable of following through.
Did they stay together?
Well, they were back and forth. Uh-huh. And uh-huh. ultimately, no.
Yeah.
It's hard to be married to somebody who's a compulsive gambler, you know, because all of a sudden you're eating dinner and the lights go out. And then my, you know, in the darkness, you hear my dad go, God damn it, I played that electric bill, this mail system, and in a world I, you know.
Oh, my God. Would they fight a lot over that?
It wasn't stuff that we were exposed to so much. Occasionally, uh-huh. we would overhear something like, Tommy, what is your problem, you know? And he borrowed money from everybody, lost it.
Yeah. Did he try to get help? Was he?
No. I mean, that wasn't he was just a hustler.
Yeah.
You know?
It was who he was. But
it was in his DNA.
Now, that definitely explains your grandfather's position when you're in college and feeling like you may need to make up for some of his past.
And he was there for me. My grandfather, was the one who ended up being stable and reinforcing that dynamic between the two of them.
Wow,
it was crazy to see it play
That's
out like that.
Fascinating.
Back to the handkerchief story.
Yeah,
my older brother, once my grandfather Pops had passed away, he had these crazy pants that were out of something you would make fun of, you know, about like
MC Hammer.
I wish they were like all different. It was like checkers, different. Yellow, green, red, awesome. Blue, all in checkers. So,
oh my God.
You know, a statement about going out.
Yeah.
And they were dress-up pants.
Wow.
And my older brother had them made into handkerchiefs for me.
Oh,
to try to bring it full circle.
Fucking cool.
Yeah. And so.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Pants that he would actually wear out when he got dressed up.
Oh, yeah. They were. Huh. No, they were his, like, go-to party pants.
That is really cool. You know?
Do you have a go-to party outfit?
No.
My older brother Tommy, he likes to make a fashion statement from time to time. Yeah, so he'll show up occasionally in clothes.
I don't think
not
I've
dissimilar.
Met him. What does he do?
He's the talent booker and producer for The Rachel Ray Show.
Oh, how have I not? I've been on The Rachel Ray Show.
Well, then you've met my brother.
Talk about like wanting to impress your parents. That's when my mother was, I think, the most
She's
proud
like,
of
you,
me.
You made it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Wait, when were you on The Rachel Ray? What was it for?
Maybe 10 years ago. Okay. I was like, I leapt at the chance. I remember it was the kind of thing, it was a point in my career where my whoever agent was like, do you want to do this? It's Rachel Ray. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. You know, I really was excited. And my mother freaked out.
She was like, finally, you've done it.
Yeah, kind of. I mean. Oh, well, I didn't know that, Tommy.
He moved up here with me. When I came up to go to acting school.
Oh, wow. That long time. So
yeah, it was in 91.
After Chapel Hill, you went to Tisch.
Oh, yep. Exactly.
Why did you do that? Was it just...
Well, back to the point, there was nobody in my family who was in the creative arts, despite my dad auditioning for San Francisco, of San Francisco or something. It was a cop show. He was a model, like I said, and he was on... There was a board game that was a gambling board game called Pigskin Vegas, which is about football booking. He was on the cover of that. And I remember
how ironic.
He took us all to the store. And
oh, my God.
I'm sure that somebody who had a patent for that or was involved in it probably owed him money, which is how he ended up getting the job in the first place or something.
I'll tell you what.
Or my dad owed him money and was
square.
Like, I'm going to give you away. The word square was used 100 times a day.
As a podcast listener, I'm sure you know that audio piques the imagination, like especially this show. So if you really want to feel like you're in the story, check out Audible's collection of brand new exclusive thrillers.
Their titles feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. So you'll be kept on the edge of your seat.
Here's an interesting psychological thriller that is out right now. It's an Audible original. It's called Oracle. It follows an FBI psychic who can help solve missing person cases when he touches those close to the victims. But of course, it comes at a cost. He'll see the horrific moments before the victims disappeared.
Shorties, I just got chills. You have to listen along with me. You don't have to.
No.
But I think you should.
Yeah, it'd be fun. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/long or text long to 500-500. That's audible.com/long or text long to 500-500.
Hiring? Well, with Indeed, your search is over. Because you can get rid of the search and just match. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. That's because Indeed leverages over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day. It's constantly learning from your preferences. Basically, the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/long. Just go to Indeed.com/long right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/long. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, hello again. Shaboom and up and we'll meet again.
After NYU, what was the first, you had said you had no frame of reference for what it was to be an actor and how, so what was your next move? How did you make the next move? Did you just, was it as simple as going to get an agent?
Well, when you're in a program like NYU, they're really smart about creating professional actors. So they give you a lot of contacts.
Some
of the alumni who have just left come back and visit and talk to you. So and not only that, when you're in New York, I'm not sure if this is the case now, but they used to do these things called showings. And so...
Like showcases.
They were showcases.
Yeah.
So Yale and NYU, when I was in school, we did ours on the same day. So they would come to New York, all the graduating class from Yale, who that year included Paul Giamatti, who was
God.
He was the big standout that day. I mean, everybody would kind of like try to, because you were only doing scenes. So we would try to come out and see what the other actors were like. And Giamatti was the one that people wanted to see and obviously still
do. What happened to him?
Yeah. Poor guy.
Yeah.
Don't worry. He'll come around. He's got professional actor training. So,
that is
you know,
true.
He's going to have a long career. Don't worry about him. But so we did these the showings where you basically do two scenes in front of casting directors and agents in New York.
That's right.
And then you get, you know, calls to go in and have interviews. It's a huge leg up in starting. I mean, not just having the training, but being here in New York. So you're sort of on a professional career path.
So after Chapel Hill, you didn't want to set, you didn't think to yourself, oh, I'll just go try my hand at
No. My mom, one of her close friends from high school was a director. And my mom was really trying to help me make that connection. And
so she was supportive. She was like,
oh, incredibly supportive. In fact, my mom, I would say, is by far the inspiration for me being an actor because she loved the theater. So I was born on Long Island and we would always come into the city. And when we finally, when we moved when I was six, we still made yearly trips.
Come back. See, I was picturing a life of like your dad's a grifter, like a vagabond family moving around the South.
You know, there was.
But you had ties to New York.
You had major ties to New York. And my mom was really invested in the arts. And so I was like, my way of fitting into the new schools, because I went to 8 different schools by the time I had finished high school.
Wow.
And my way of fitting in was being a class clown.
Uh-huh.
And so that leaves you with no...
Yeah. Yeah.
It leaves you with no dignity, which is a great place to start as an actor.
It's true.
You don't worry about your dignity.
You don't care.
It is not a dignified profession in that way.
Yeah, it's true.
And so...
And you deal with just the vagabond lifestyle of like starting over and charming a new set of people.
You know what's
like...
fascinating too is I would have imagined after that upbringing that I would... I knew I wanted something really stable. And it's fascinating that this is what I could find.
Yeah.
You know, part of going
but it fits
to
your, that personality that was forged it, in adaptable. That because of that lifestyle.
It's true, the, yeah. that adaptability. I mean, do you did you find that growing up? You seem like
I didn't have that. We lived in the same house. We were stable, right. But I was really I don't know what to attribute it to. I was really short. I was really little. I had a hard time kind of being seen.
I was the like, shortest guy in my class.
No shit.
Until ninth grade. And then I was
short
second
high five.
Shortest. Yep. We almost reached each other across the table, but we're too short.
Our limbs wouldn't reach across this tiny, shallow
Our
table.
Our fingertips barely touched. A couple of short actors trying to do a high five.
I remember meeting you for the first time and being shocked by how short you were. Not that you're short, but like, I always, because I had seen you only in movies.
I feel that
movies.
Every day. Yeah. No, seeing me on the big screen.
Yeah, I had. Yeah. I had. And to me, you were a big movie star. So to see someone this tiny little diminutive.
Well, but, I've worn lifts ever since then.
Yeah, because I just kept saying, "Wow."
I felt the same about you. Your name betrayed.
Yeah, that's true.
Everything about
it's an
you.
An unfortunate name for a short person. That's true. Speaking of names, I've known you for I think 18
yeah,
years
it's
now.
It's crude up.
Is it?
Yeah, it's crude up.
I still don't believe you.
Yeah, it's true. It's crude up.
Every time I say it, I don't have confidence.
I know,
about it.
I know.
I know I've asked you this even.
If you think of it this way, Billy screwed up.
Oh.
It's always there for you.
Oh, yeah.
That's a regular thing for me.
And then, would they call you that?
No.
Because they didn't know how to pronounce it.
No, it used
to be. They call
you
scrud up. Scrowed up. Scrowed up.
No, it's screwed. Well, it used to have crude an up. Umlaut over it. It was German.
Oh, what? Crude up. It's a crude up.
Yeah.
It was. Why did you say so?
It was, I think, K R U with an umlaut D O P P.
Crude up.
But there's a whole subsection of crude ups in the States who pronounce it crud up. So there was a famous blues musician, Arthur Big Boy Crud Up.
A blues musician.
Blues musician, no. Actually, I did feel one time Tom Cruise pronounced my name crud up, and I just wanted to say, okay, Cruz.
Yeah, Tom Cruz.
But even still, screwed like today, I've kind of given up on it. You know, my mom tried her best to help people pronounce my name correctly, and I ran for vice president of the student body when I was probably in fifth grade or sixth grade. And so,
was that like an attempt to ingratiate yourself in the school?
Well, that was an attempt to do two things. One, public service was a big part of some of the people that I hung around. I was a Boy Scout, and my grandfather was a bishop in the Episcopalian Church. You know, community service. They were how high did you get as a Boy Scout? Wait, that's not framed correctly. What rank did you ascend to?
Oh,
dude, I was
high. No, it's ironic. I mean, speaking of high, it's when I discovered stuff like that. Girls and contraband. And growing up Catholic, girls were part of contraband.
Right.
But when I was like, wait a minute.
So Catholic is not far away from Episcopalian.
No. I mean,
the papacy is probably about the only difference.
My parents would disagree. They're like, it's a world apart. a lot of Catholics would disagree. But no, when I discovered girls, I was like, wait a minute, girls aren't impressed by this uniform and they're not impressed by the fact that I got reptile study merit badge on my own. I had so many merit badges.
I had no idea.
You know, remember the term Joe Scout?
No.
Oh, they would call kids who were like really gung-ho.
Oh, God.
And, like, did stuff extracurricular badges and stuff. That's what I would do. I wanted to fill out my set.
That's phenomenal. Of course, man. Yeah. And the kerchief, did you wear it?
Oh, I loved it. The whole thing. And then like that, I was right on the verge. All I needed was to do my Eagle Scout project.
Get out of here.
Yeah. I was I could have gotten it when I was like 12, 13 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I was.
Does that haunt you?
No.
Why not? Eagle Scouts are amazing.
It's slightly annoying, I'll be honest.
I knew you were an Eagle Scout, I would have actually said yes to this.
Yeah, it's true. You never really said, I'm shocked you showed up.
Yeah, I hope this isn't being recorded, and I don't know what all this equipment is about.
Oh, this is a ruse. What rank did you get to?
I think the one just before life.
Star.
Star. Yeah. Yeah. Star.
You were always a star.
I said, you know what? I'm going to stop right here at star. I don't need to be a lifer or a bird flying high.
Why did you leave Scouts? Why did you stop doing it?
Same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's like, what are we doing?
Well, and my mom busted us so bad. Me and my older brother, because he was a scout as well. And he was like you. He only had to complete one other thing before he became an Eagle Scout. My dad was super into the scouts too. Like he loved like going on the camping trips with us and teaching us about knots and knives. And
Really? Oh, he'd go on the trip?
Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
He loved it and loved that part of our upbringing. But at a certain point... they had divorced, and my brother and I then got into video games. We got into going to the video parlor.
Oh, because this was like mid-80s.
This is 83.
This is like Centipede.
Correct. Defender.
Oh, wow. Galaga.
Donkey Kong. We would put on our scout uniform. Because it was Monday night and we were going to our scout meeting. Uh-huh. But underneath, we had our civilian clothes. And as soon as we got in the car, we would take off our scout uniform and go to the video arcade. And after about a month of this, we come home one night and my mom looks at the two of us and goes, "So how was Boy Scouts?" And like just internally, I'm going, that didn't sound like a real upfront question. And she goes,
"I don't know much about subtext, but I'm too young to really discover."
And she's like, "Your scoutmaster called," and like I immediately broke into tears. Uh-huh. So that was the end of scouts for me.
Did you get your merit badge in arcade games? Arcading? Arcadia, which brings us to Arcadia.
Yes.
Was that the first big, by the way, I'm proud of myself for that segue.
That was an incredible thing. You know what? I might just leave now because how are we going to do better?
I don't know.
What's our time like? Oh, yeah.
Oh, we got about 3 minutes.
Oh,
what was that? That was the big.
That was, I was like 6 months out of school and I did a.
6 months?
6 months.
Holy shit.
And I did a play. I got my equity card at, I think it was Purchase.
SUNY Purchase. Purchase your equity card.
I didn't. Oh, correct. You know what? Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. This could have become a legal issue. Yeah. It was a Sherlock Holmes mystery. It was a phenomenal production. I played the lurking butler in the background who may or may not be having a relationship with his master.
I can see that. You'd be a great lurking butler.
I crushed it. And that led me to a off-Broadway production called America Dreaming, written by Chiori Miyagawa, directed by Michael Mayer, also with Joel Delafuente.
Oh, weird.
At the Vineyard Theater.
Oh, my God. And that's where I kept seeing your face.
And so that was the first place I ever did a play in New York.
No shit. I didn't know that.
And then I did an independent movie called Grind with...
I'm listening.
It was about it was a race about a car driver. App. It was with Paul Scholze and the late Adrienne Shelley. She was amazing and lovely person. And Amanda Peet was in that as well. And directed by Chris Kentis.
This is months after. So this you must is be all within like,
the. I was working a lot for the first three or four months right after. I was really lucky in getting
so
stuff.
There's no waiting tables. There's no like.
The waiting tables I did in between years.
Yeah.
You know, I did that in college before. In college, I was a hustler too, trying to make money just for my, you know, so I parked cars, I delivered pizzas and subs. And
that's a metaphor for pimping.
What do you call it?
Oh, just pimping.
Just pimping.
Honest,
oh,
yeah.
You're a straight up pimp.
Yeah.
Okay, so you call it pimping. I was a waiter during the summers when I was doing it. And then when I graduated, I got a couple of jobs really quick.
Crazy.
And then I had auditioned for Arcadia.
So this is Tom. So Tom Stoppard at this point had already done Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you're well aware of who he is.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, and
we had seen him in scene study classes. And,
yeah.
You know.
Sure.
I mean, there was.
So you knew what a potentially huge thing this was.
Oh, no question about it. It was at Lincoln Center, directed by Trevor Nunn.
Wow.
None
other.
So it was really.
Sorry. Oh boy.
Trevor Nunn was, I think, at the time, the youngest person to occupy the head of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Oh, wow.
And he was already a formidable figure in my mind. Hmm. So the idea that I could be doing a play at Lincoln Center with those two was just outrageous. Hmm. And then you start to read it, and the part is one of a kind. Mm-hmm. It is amongst the most beautifully written heroic parts that you'll find. And, you know, but I did the audition and Daniel Sui gave me a piece of direction and I just couldn't do it at the time. Like it was about him being self-conscious about his own intellectual capability and the fact that he was a tutor. He hated being a tutor. So he was always like throwing in these little grenades that he knew the 13-year-old wouldn't get. And he was just doing it to amuse himself. But it required a kind of sophisticated and ennui that I didn't have. I was more like sweat and energy. That was my major feature as an actor. Is coming in with a whole lot of energy.
And you're a hell of a lurker.
And I lurk. Yeah. So I left and I thought, oh crap. I know what he means. Maybe I can get back in there. I called my agent and as soon as I was on the call, you discovered this is a call he gets every day from a million actors. Like, please get me back in. I understand it now. And he was like, okay, I'll give him a call. He called Daniel Sui. He was like, you know what? Billy's just not right for the part. But I was so excited that I understood what he meant that I kept working on it myself because I was still in the acting student kind of phase of my career.
Oh, my God.
And so
during, you weren't disheartened. You didn't think you would go back.
I knew that I didn't get it right at the time. Yeah. You know, I was disappointed that I didn't get a shot back in. But at that time, you're auditioning all the time.
Right.
I didn't get that audition and go, this part. You know, you're lucky that you get the audition and that you get to spend some time with Daniel Sui and that he helps to, you know, frame where your talent might be. Mm-hmm. Useful, you know, for Lincoln Center.
You still have this student mentality.
Understanding and growing your own. I mean, that was a big thing we learned at NYU because of the teacher there, Ron Van Leeuwen, and his entire group was like, you're here not to learn our system. You're here to develop your own system. Hmm. So we're going to give you all these tools and it's up to you to refine that as your career changes, as your body changes, as, you know, like.
I like that.
It was a great approach. I was like, I don't want to leave this fucking place $80,000 in debt without a system.
Yeah.
I could have created a system myself. Yeah. You know, it's true. You become Wally Shawn in that moment. I created it myself.
It's inconceivable I would leave without a system.
I just wanted to give you an opportunity.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Low-hanging fruit. Wait, what? What was the system you developed? Is there any way to articulate it now? And has it changed?
It has changed insofar as it becomes more sophisticated. The truth is, it's really about the story. It's about you as an actor being able to find stories that you know you can go to and be an authentic part of somebody else's version of an entertaining evening.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not about like creating an acting style you have the flexibility to hopefully be able to do whatever kinds of jobs are then available for you. Like whether it's in the theater, whether it's independent movie, whether it's satire, whether it's realism.
And this is something, I mean, you're speaking as Billy right now, like, so this is something you've developed over that you've learned over since you started. But back then, were you beholden to a different approach, like a different methodology?
It was all story and instrument based. That is to say, get your body right, make sure that you can be flexible, that you can do different accents, that you can sustain the energy to do a language play. Well,
you ended up playing a lot of different characters. I mean, you ended up employing that method in a lot of different characters early on. Like, that's rare, I think, for an actor to, especially like a good-looking guy to play different characters.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you just said.
A very good-looking guy.
Oh, thanks, Justin. Yeah, didn't need to say that.
To play, well, it was here in your rider.
No.
I'm just following what your reps told me to say.
I don't see anything.
That's right here.
I'm looking at the same spot you are, and all I see is a tablecloth. I see a tablecloth, and I see a pouch full of, I don't know what's in that, but.
Cocaine.
Okay.
I think Monument Avenue. Part like that, and a completely different, and Sleeper, these like kind of like rough net,
characters, I hate using the term edge, with an edge, it's kind of like rougher characters.
Yeah, fringy kind of people. Yeah. Well, I mean, I met a lot of them growing up with my dad, yeah.
But now I see where they came from.
Yeah, one of his associates was a man named Mr. O, who was a 6'4" former boxer who had a pit bull named Bullet.
Why Mr. O?
I guess because when people saw him, they'd be like, ooh.
It's pronounced ooh.
Oh, or oh no. You know, I think he was my dad's heavy for a while. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, they carried guns and, you know, but it was always under the guise of, this is all cool, don't worry. Uh-huh. Like, I remember they took
me. You never were scared around them.
Well, I would, you get scared when they're driving drunk. That's that's when you get scared. But the other stuff, I mean.
Excuse me, Mr. O.
It's not that you.
Would you mind if I, you know.
How about I take over? Yeah. I mean, listen, my older brother Tommy did a lot of caretaking in that area. He was driving before he should have been driving.
Wow.
And he was heroic in that. That was the kind of stuff that was. But the other stuff, he was just like, you know, like he had this shotgun next to his bed. And it was a sawed-off, like, riot shotgun. And his point of view would just be like, nah, you don't want to touch that.
Oh my God! And you were never tempted. God.
No, never tempted. Just the way that he would. I mean, I didn't know much about guns, you know, myself, and his attitude was so cavalier that you were kind of won over by it. So anyway, you start reading these characters, and you go, "Well, I kind of have an angle on that."
Yeah, I know,
you
know that guy.
The morning show that I'm doing right now, the guy's an angler.
Ugh, he's so good on it.
Thanks, man. But he's a straight up hustler.
Totally.
And these are the guys who walk into any room, they read the room, they're poker players.
Yes.
They bet on their own capability to understand the situation.
Well, so just to contextualize it really quick, Jennifer Aniston is this character who on a morning show whose co-anchor, played by Steve Carell, is kind of it's clearly modeled after Matt Lauer, and he's a guy who's been has all these sexual misconduct lawsuits that just all of a sudden get released, and so he leaves. And Aniston's left to kind of deal with this, the fallout from it. And
correct.
It's so interesting how they.
And she's in the middle of, by the way, of renegotiating new contract for herself.
And you're a new executive.
New executive who is seeing that the show's ratings have been slipping.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks he has a point of view about why they've been slipping. And he thinks it's because Jen and Steve's characters have kind of like. They're phoning it in.
Yeah.
There's no energy. There's no vitality.
Yeah.
And frankly, he doesn't feel in judgment about that, like, personally. But from a corporate point of view, he feels like they have a responsibility to ignite people because they have this kinds of opportunity. So he's sort of pissed at Jennifer.
Yeah.
Jennifer's character's Alex, for not using
delivering
opportunity to draw in people with the lack of enthusiasm, incitement.
And again, it's all, you said it, he just quantifies these things. There's nothing like, well, there's no sentimentality attached to it. There's no.
He doesn't mean in a pejorative way.
No.
He's just like, I want to show you the numbers. I'm a numbers guy.
You give a speech that is about, you say that humanity is addicted to the news and they all get it in the palm of their hands. And the networks are in danger of becoming obsolete because of that. Because they're, and I felt, it was interesting because this is on a new streaming platform. It's on Apple TV. And I felt like you could have been talking about any of these new streaming services and the way people are getting any sort of entertainment.
Show. It's a show that is trying to explore things in a meta kind of way, which is that they're happening to the characters while they're happening to us.
Yeah.
So the fact that Apple would allow for a show that talks about, I mean, you should
you say tech is taking over.
Oh, you should have. And when we did the first reading of the pilot, the first two episodes, when I said with like, indignation, if we don't watch out, we're all going to be taken over by tech.
Yeah.
These guys loved it. Oh, they thought it was hilarious.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they really found like that whole exchange fascinating.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. It is. The change in our cultural delivery system.
It's like seismic. It's like crazy. And what better way? Why not just address it? If, like, since this show, a lot of the buzz around this show is that it's this hugely expensive new thing for Apple. Why not just like get out in front, just like address it?
I think that's kind of you know, I thought it was smart too.
Yeah.
And
I love that exchange. I love that scene. And you say nobody wants to watch it because you're talking about how that Carell and Aniston's character had been there was an undercurrent of like sexual tension between these two.
Yeah, that we're counting on. Listen, yeah, part of the responsibility of the morning anchors who start the day for so many millions of Americans is to be mom and dad.
Yeah, a stable, loving couple.
And part of being mom and dad is sometimes they have sex.
Right.
Like, so they need to be a little bit sexy and a little bit flirty too.
Yeah.
And
so I never considered that.
Me neither until I read that on the thing. And I was like, well, that's an interesting point of view. If it's not true, it's at least interesting.
You're like, wait, Regis? As in Kathy? It sheds a whole new light on all that.
Life could be a dream, sweetheart.
Doo-doo-doo-doo-shaboom.
Want to hear a really satisfying sound? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations. With Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts, you can start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I've been loving learning Spanish because I love traveling to Spanish-speaking countries, and I just want to be better at communicating with the people. I love the people there, and I want to be able to get to know them better. I also love the food, so I'd like to be better at ordering food so I don't order the wrong thing. They teach you very practical, real-world language skills. And here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/long. Get 55% off at babbel.com/long, spelled BABBEL.com/long. Rules and restrictions may apply.
If you run an e-commerce business, you know the amount of work it takes to produce something great.
So if you want to optimize your workflow and reduce costs, ShipStation is the multi-carrier shipping solution that integrates wherever you sell online.
ShipStation's simple dashboard makes managing orders, smooth label printing, reporting, and customer service unbelievably easy.
With shipping configurations automatically applied, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online.
Plus, save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off UPS, DHL Express, and USPS rates. Over 130,000 companies have grown their e-commerce businesses with ShipStation.
ShipStation is the innovative tool that helps turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth.
Go to ShipStation.com and use code LONG to sign up for your free 60-day trial.
That's ShipStation.com, code LONG.
Hello, hello again, shaboom, and up we'll meet again.
Your first two movies were Everyone Says I Love You and Sleeper, which is Barry Levinson and Woody Allen.
Well, Barry Levinson was some, you know, Diner was like, it was a family movie. We watched it all time.
Wow.
And so Tin Men, you know, Avalon,
Barry Levinson. Good Morning Vietnam.
Barry Levinson was, you know, like, it was Robert De Niro, Dustin Hoffman, Brad Pitt, Minnie Driver, you know, like Jason Patrick, Ron Eldar, like a phenomenal actors.
Kevin Bacon, shout out.
Kevin Bacon.
Former.
What in the hell? How could I even forget?
Podcast.
And also, Jonathan Tucker played a younger me.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was incredible.
Was that just like an easy, like, that's an easy.
I fought for that one. I actually, I think Barry Levinson or the casting director had come and had seen Arcadia.
Uh-huh.
But needless to say, there was a stark contrast between
those two characters,
Septimus and Tommy Marcano.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, that's an example of like that's when people first see you, and you're this lowlife. You're this kind of like. So you had to really, what it just meant, like auditioning and proving yourself.
You know, those kinds of things before, because there's a difference between having some success on stage and people trusting you on film. So it having that part in Arcadia, it got me in the room.
Right.
But I had to audition for Tommy Marcano several times. Like, because he wanted to make sure I could get the accent right. It took me a while to get the accent right, you know.
And what is that like? Because you're friends with a lot of actors. I mean, I know you through Sam and you're friends with Ethan and all those guys. You must be competing then with all your friends for these parts.
Well, you know, my friendships with those guys sort of came as we became professionals. And you did meet in like audition rooms or, you know, competing.
How'd you meet Sam?
But, I think it was like his third stay in rehab, and I was there to do some community service work.
Oh, that's so nice.
And he said he liked
his shopping
acting.
Addiction. Sam, not a lot of people know this. Sam Rockwell's a
he's a shopaholic. I mean, I tell you what, if you see a sale while you're with him, run the other way.
Don't try calling him on Black Friday. He will not pick up his phone.
Sam was somebody like who I always admired. And actually, you know, I think I first probably encountered him socially at CBGB's gallery going to see Peter Sillette play.
No kidding.
And there was the whole cadre of young actors that loved going there. And but most of my early friends were from acting school. And so
Phil Hoffman, you were really good.
Well, I knew Phil because he had the same agent that I did. And I met Phil I think he had just done Twister or something, and I
was these fucking tornadoes.
Yeah, exactly. And I was out in L.A. for the first time with my agent because she wanted me to meet with like casting directors and stuff. And she said, "You have to meet this actor I represent, who is the king, Phil Hoffman." And I was like, "Well, I can't wait." And the three of us went out and had dinner, and that's, you know.
Yeah. And then you'd work with him on Almost Famous.
We worked on Almost Famous, but, you know, like separately.
Separately, yeah, that's right. His part was kind of done in a couple days. And
it was the same with Mission Impossible. We saw each other in passing.
Oh, yeah.
And every time we were on the set together, it was kind of like, you know, one of the reasons I'm doing this is because you're in it. I had such admiration for him and his work.
What inspired that Almost Famous performance? Was it based on somebody specific? It seems so specific.
That's a Cameron Crowe invention.
Really?
There, man. I mean, that no question about it. And that was another one that I had to fight for. I didn't play guitar, and, you know, it was Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt was going
to
do it.
Brad Pitt was going to do it, and he dropped out. And so I flew out to L.A.
He wasn't gorgeous enough.
I think that was the problem.
Yeah,
I think that was the problem. He was hot, but not hot.
Not crude up hot.
Not hot. Not triple hot. And he left an open. Actually, many of the jobs that I got and still get are because people dropped out. Keanu Reeves dropped out of Watchmen.
No kidding.
Yeah. And
is that you don't have any sort of ego about it? There's
I if you're an actor, it is not.
There's so many. I mean, is it just that?
It's constant.
Yeah.
You know, if you let yourself be weighed down by the opposing forces, and I feel the same way about, you know, like the sort of tradition with acting in the theater, somebody else has played the part, this is your chance to play the part. It's not a competition with the person who did it before. I'm not going to be like going after Gielgud Scioglioni, you know. I shall stamp Gielgud Scioglioni into the ground. You know, like it's that you get to be a part of this, like, you know, long tradition of storytelling.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's the way that and also it ends up being an opportunity. And Cameron.
Sure.
Cameron knew this story inside out, knew this character inside and out. So he was the one who really built it.
So he didn't say it was okay, this is Led Zeppelin, this is who I want you to watch.
No.
It was just a matter of getting the guitar down.
It was getting the guitar down and getting the spirit. You know, one of the things, because I wanted to be more like Dwayne Allman because mostly he just sat in the shadows and didn't move and, like, you know, threw in these crazy licks.
Yeah.
And that was a way for me to be like, I don't know how to play guitar, so can I play, can I be that guy in the shadows?
That's funny.
And Cameron was kind of like, well, sort of, but that's the character is also like the most charismatic.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I don't know how to like. And Nancy Wilson and Peter Frampton were the guitar.
Can't have better instructors.
I mean, they were our. We had
because
wow.
It looks like you can play.
Camp.
I mean, yeah.
Well, that's you know, looks like I can run too.
Yeah.
And, and I can't do any of those.
Looks like you're a menacing bad guy in Mission Impossible.
Exactly. Looks like I'm sitting on Mars in Watchmen. But
looks
I can't.
Like you have
I can't
a nice blue dick.
I can't do any of that. I do.
By the way, we're getting to that.
No, that I do. But I think that's why so most that's Cameron's. Creation.
Oh, wow.
Russell
was trying to hold on to this artistic integrity.
While the popularity of the group was growing,
mm-hmm.
and I think the confusion about where his artistry and his popularity came mm-hmm. into conflict, it left him silent and stoic. And then that's why he ends up becoming the guitarist with Mystique.
Right.
It's because he's just trying to not say the wrong thing. Exactly.
Right.
You know,
To that point, you also said, I'll never forget this. I remember reading an interview of yours around that time where you were responding to why you didn't do a lot of press. And you said, I'm going to paraphrase it, something along the lines of, well, the more interviews and more press I do, the harder it is for me to do my job.
No question. I just didn't feel like I was a good enough actor, and I didn't think I was going to ride the fame train. That's not how I perceived as a career as an actor. That seemed like a pretty risky thing to do.
Well, you probably also witnessed a lot of people on that train who then burn out.
I had seen that.
Yeah.
I had seen that over the first couple of years. I was doing photo shoots with all of those people and, you know, like, here's the next five guys.
On the Vanity Fair cover.
It happens, you know, and I was definitely aware of the pitfalls of that, but it was also really important for me. I felt like because I did not feel so confident as an actor, and I knew that I wanted to be a character actor, was to not have a public persona.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't have a public persona, that I mean, I'm older now. I'm sort of in the middle of my career, so it doesn't feel risky to me in the same way to describe it.
You even said, when you said this in the interview, I want to point out, you even said, I know this seems hypocritical. I'm saying this in an interview. But it was for Almost Famous, and I imagine it was one of those things that you kind of had to do.
Well, there's no question. And there were things that I was supposed to do that I didn't do that I got a lot of heat for. And I suspect that that interview was in the was a magazine or
well,
it's a lot easier to do that than to do an interview like that in print than it is to do Leno, or to do Letterman,
Know,
or
of course.
Like those
not
kinds
as revealing.
Of, well, those things exactly. People put a face to the name, and then they see, and you're on those shows to try to win an audience in a way, win an audience for your movie or your play or your TV show or whatever. And who am I kidding? They would have never had me on for a play.
That's probably not true. I mean,
but you want to ingratiate yourself to that audience, which requires a certain performance.
Yeah,
and it's a performance that's written by you and curated by you. And when I had Barry Levinson and Tom Stoppard write me shit before, I didn't want to be writing my own material either.
Yeah.
And so there were a number of things that I think added to the general philosophy that the less I do, the better long term for my career.
I was also
resentful, just to get myself into trouble, but I was resentful that film companies
like they cared about that stuff.
Well, not only that, they leverage it. Their point is, your privacy needs to be invaded so we can get publicity for the movie that we've just paid you for.
Well, now they do with social media. I mean, it's taken a step further.
Did you start doing interviews like right away?
Once people wanted me to, I never fought it, even though I really admired. I'll never forget reading that as a young actor and like really admired you and your career. But I never forgot that. I was.
But
like,
what was your experience? Because you have a lot of the fact is you have a podcast because you actually can be creative. You have I'm sure you write too.
Yeah, I write with my brother. It's the best. This is the best outlet. But I'm also very really fascinated. But I get to talk to you. I get to talk to people I admire. And but I look back at some of the early interviews I did and I don't really recognize that person. All I know is that that's why it's interesting what you just said, is you're curating your own performance, your own narrative. I remember, all I can say is that I guess at the time I thought that was cool or charming or something, but it doesn't feel like me. I mean, I look at some like,
right.
And just because I was a jumble of nerves and like trying to look cool and yep. trying to look casual, and it's embarrassing, but it's also kind of interesting to see
it makes me think of like politicians. Uh-huh. It's like somehow yeah. when you're super young, you've got a number of people who are trying to help you create the image that they think is you. So you're right. getting like they've done they've canvassed the area, right?
Yeah.
They've canvassed the area.
This
and
is what works.
This is where you fit into this environment. So uh-huh. you're getting a lot of different information. Probably people are giving you clothes to wear.
I wore an ascot.
I wore my own clothes for every photo shoot and every appearance the longest time just as a fuck you. Because I was like, I am not a model.
It's amazing.
Like, look at the pictures of me at the Almost Famous premiere.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to.
I'm wearing my favorite pair of gray corduroys and a white Oxford shirt untucked.
That's amazing.
And like my
was your publicist like, come on, Billy, this
oh,
is
by
a
that
moment.
Time they had all, they were given up. So hating me. I mean, the level of loathing everybody and you know, it was petulant in a way too, because I was also resentful of the studios for relying on actors' personal lives to be exploited for the benefit of their movies. I thought, mm-hmm. listen, man, I think it's an easier thing to pay me less. I'll work for less. And you guys spend that money on advertising.
Mm, yeah.
That doesn't involve people going through my garbage.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like, how about that? And they're yeah. like, no, we will pay you $0 for that.
Yeah.
You know, they're,
God,
and,
it's true.
I did ask somebody that. At one point, I was like, okay, so how much just for the acting?
That's funny. Yeah.
yeah.
Really quick, your favorite, these are just short answers. Speed round.
Yes.
Lightning round. What's your most commonly used emoji?
Thumbs up.
If you could be a professional athlete, what sport would you play?
Basketball.
That is such a – that's the
That'd
most milquetoast answer.
No, I'd be like Muggsy Bogues.
Yeah.
Are you, can you imagine?
If you were talented.
Oh, yeah, that's what I said. Yeah. If I could play yes. any sport, if I could play.
You tower over Muggsy Bogues.
He's 5'3". He's 5'4". I was going to say unbelievable.
Who do you root for? Do you root for basketball still? I mean,
college basketball.
UNC
the
still.
Yankees, because my dad was a Yankees fan, and after he died, I started watching baseball.
And you go with your son, with Will?
Yeah, but he can't stand it. I have to bribe him.
In fact, really?
In fact, when they were in the playoffs this past time,
yeah.
I said, I want to get tickets for me and you and Uncle Tommy. And he was like, well, let's make a deal. And I was like, oh, come on, man. I'm taking you to a yeah. Yankees playoff game. And he's like, nope, I'm going to need a day at Six Flags. And so I was like, so just this past weekend, I took him and his buddy Zev to Six Flags, and it was 45 degrees outside.
Oh God, so
it was unbelievable. Yeah,
well, I guess I'm not going to any more baseball
games. He's not so into that. He does like college basketball. And yeah.
Okay. If you could have one snack food for the rest of your life, your go-to, you're stoned, I need something in my mouth.
You're killing me here, because I know. Oh, well, popcorn. I mean, I make my own popcorn. You know,
ooh.
Yeah. I mean, like by that, I grow the corn, and I harvest the vegetable oil from the field.
Right,
crude up corn.
I
don't know why I got into this, but the actual chemistry of making a good piece of popcorn
uh-huh.
is not uncomplicated. So you have to make sure that the oil is super hot. That when
you do it on a skillet,
you do it in like a little pan, right?
Uh-huh.
And you get avocado oil or something that has like a high smoke point.
I can't tell if you're joking right now.
I'm totally serious. Okay, I'm 100% serious. And you, I prefer the white corn over the yellow corn.
Slightly racist,
it's lighter in texture and flavor. And so you get it super hot. You put three kernels in there. As soon as the first one goes, you dump the rest of it in there, you start shaking, and then you have to find a way to let the steam out as it's going. So you have to really work it so that no steam, because if the steam gets in there, then what has happened to the actual popcorn is it starts to get soggy really quick. So if you can keep the steam out of there and get it to all pop really quickly and then let it cool for 2 minutes, I'm telling you, it is...
I just opened Pandora's box. I can't believe that just happened.
No, I've...
Well, you can tell Will, that's why you were late.
Anybody...
You were talking about popcorn.
He'll know that's true,
oh,
actually,
really?
Yeah.
How'd you get into that?
That's a good question. It probably came from like making popcorn for him and being like, well, that's kind of stale.
Yeah.
How do you make good popcorn? Like, why don't I just know how to make?
By the way, I'm going to do that now.
Oh, I'd be more than happy to come over and give you a tutorial.
Jesus, I hadn't.
You can make it for your Instagram. And
great content.
By the way,
Sam is
a popcorn aficionado himself.
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, you put a little, Sam, what do you use, as a, drizzle over the top of it? Do you use like a butter flavoring or,
I've been trying to lose a little weight for, the next thing. So I've been doing nutritional yeast. Leslie got me on, it tastes like butter. It's fucking awesome. It's awesome.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm glad you had that opportunity.
Thank you.
Let me just tell you what you want to use.
Yeah, what?
Is olive oil. And at the moment, I'm preferring olive oil from Spain.
Oh, fuck. It's the one time I wish this were filmed. I wish people could have seen your face when you said, from Spain.
And here's another thing you have to do with the salt, okay? This is a crucial part of the salt component, is you get...
A crucial part.
You get you get some of the, like, sea salt, you know, Himalayan sea salt.
From which
sea,
preferably?
You know, yeah, well, there is the Himalayan sea salt, like which pink, you can, yes. Like the pink sea salt.
By the way, Phil were alive to hear. He would be making so much fun of you.
I would have so many punches in my face right now.
Oh, my God. Quit up if you don't stop talking about...
So then you get a mortar and pestle, and... You have to crush up that salt really fine.
Okay.
That's it. And so then after you put that little bit of Spanish olive
oil on there. So it's distributed evenly?
So it's distributed evenly, mm-hmm. And so you don't get like the single.
Yeah. Big kernel of grain.
Salt, yeah.
So, okay.
It's a delicate joy.
God, I wish
just
we had
like
more time
you.
To talk about popcorn. Thanks. If you could live somewhere else, where would it be?
I'm a big fan of Paris.
Okay.
I like Paris and London.
What's your favorite movie of all time?
I had to write a paper on The Deer Hunter, and that was a legendary film. And I would put that Cool Hand Luke, some of the ones that I can remember growing up watching with my dad.
You played 70s type. Anti-hero. Like, I think Jesus' son is such a good example of that. I had all of these questions to ask you about that, but your son has to be picked up and...
Billy's son.
Okay, if you could have dinner with three people, dead or alive, whom you've never met.
Ooh. God, it seems like... who are your go-tos?
Well, this is not about me. Nice try. We could go to another one if you need to stall.
How can you see through my tactic
good, right?
there so quickly?
Who's your favorite Muppet? The one
Kermit.
Kermit, yeah. If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
To not cry
so
often. Even talking about it.
Whoa, yeah. Whoa, I'm sorry I brought that up. I'm sorry I brought up superpowers.
No, for sure to fly.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be to fly.
Yeah. How great. If you could be one age for the rest of your life, physically, what would you pick?
I confess, I don't know a non-pompous way of putting this.
Yeah, that's
but,
okay.
But I like having to have the human experience of getting new ages.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah, well, it's not going to happen.
By the way,
it's all hypothetical.
51 isn't great. Yeah. Your body doesn't move quite the same.
That's
but also,
saying.
It's 51.
Yeah.
And I didn't ever experience 51 until now.
Yeah.
I have to say, at 27 or 28, you kind of feel peak and you don't know it yet.
Exactly.
Because
that's
the
problem.
You get to 38 and you go, God, I was right there. And I didn't know.
I squandered
it. Holy, I could have run around Manhattan 100 times.
It
looked great. You know,
I would have tried to do more backflips.
Youth
like
is wasted on the young.
Yes,
yep.
God damn. Life is short. If you could be reincarnated as, and I keep saying as a non-human animal, what would it be? But that's, people say that's redundant.
Yeah. I'd just go with as an animal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Wolves are pretty cool. Was that your stomach?
Yes. Yeah.
I thought I was the one digesting pizza.
It was a fart.
Do you eat?
It was a fart that I...
That came up through your body? And
out of respect, I didn't want to let it out.
Good for you.
Thanks.
Oh, your insides are in turmoil.
Yeah, well, they're not... They're slightly frustrated with me. Okay, let's see. Done. We're almost done. Dogs or cats? Do you have a preference?
Dogs. Oh, for sure, dogs.
Yeah. Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Oh, I mean, how do you beat the Beatles? I listen to the Stones all the time.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
If you could choose Meatloaf the food or Meatloaf the singer, you could only...
Singer.
Oh, yeah.
I used to go see the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Uh-huh.
And the theater that we would go to, the Coconut Grove Playhouse.
Oh, in Florida. In Fort Lauderdale.
In Miami, but we would drive from Fort Lauderdale.
It's a great theater.
It was a great, great theater. Yeah. And I don't know if it's still there, but they would play it on Fridays or Saturday nights. I can't remember which. But they would always open with the Meatloaf, with that great duet, the baseball.
Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Paradise by the Dashboard Light, that video of that.
Well, I talk about this way too much on the show, but you got to see Bat Out of Hell. I saw it twice. I was in
London. Oh, okay. I haven't seen it. All right.
It's fucking great. Okay. It's so fun. Okay. Well, your epitaph, legacy, do you ever think about that? The afterlife. This is not a short question, maybe, but do you ever think how you want to be remembered, or what's next, what's beyond this?
I don't. I mean, I guess you know, I'm kind of an empiricist, so until the evidence suggests that there is something else going on, it's hard for me to spend a lot of time thinking about all the possibilities. I kind of spend my time thinking about what's happening here.
Yeah.
And
is
now
that one of the benefits of doing film, that there's a degree of permanence to it?
Well, I mean, as soon as you start to think about it, you have some sort of understanding of the way that the world works, and maybe a little understanding of astronomy, you know that this planet is going to be consumed by the sun, and all of the movies you made are going to melt with it.
And that's our show, ladies and gentlemen.
So I don't rely on any of the permanence of. Of course, our egos get in the way of thinking, oh, I'm now, it's there forever. Nothing is there forever. So as far as I can see right now.
Including you on this show. The season finale for The Morning Show is December 20th.
What's next for Billy Crudup?
Jiminy Glick is one of my favorites.
I've always wanted to know. What's going on in the mind of Billy?
God, I really wish I had worked on it a little bit, because I used to do one.
Oh, really?
Who do you do?
Justin Long. You love things.
You know, I haven't worked on it long enough.
Oh, my
God.
I know, is it Crudup? Crudup.
You know, sometimes I... What is that? What is that about? What is it about Justin Long and everything he does for the world?
What's what? Oiled and turned into
turned
into Mr. O. Your dad's.
I really should have worked on it, because God, I used to love Jiminy Glick. What's next? I'm going to do season two of this, I'm going to do this play, Harry Clark, that I did in L.A. Hopefully for like 6 weeks next year.
Great, because it's been a huge guilty sticking point that I didn't see it when it was at the Vineyard.
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
That's why I'm doing
it
again.
You probably thought I'd see it.
That's why I'm doing it again.
In L.A.
I'll do it for you right now.
Oh, just please.
I'll keep my son waiting.
Yes. Wait, when are you doing that?
Probably next November.
Great.
If everything works out right.
Okay, in L.A. Good. And then Morning Show. And thanks, pal.
Thank you, buddy.
Fun.
I really enjoyed it.
For hours. So,
well, that just happened.
Yep.
He is such an impressive human being.
Isn't he?
Oof.
Yeah.
God.
Calm down.
Handsome.
Why are you sweating?
Funny.
Oh, my God. Why are you taking off your
introspective
pants?
Introspective.
Oh, my God.
He is just
what's happening?
He's the total package.
He is. Speaking of packages, I am...
Ugh.
Why?
What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say...
Oh, you just got a delivery downstairs.
Yeah. I was just going to say I'm really mad at myself for not asking more questions about his... his blue penis in Watchmen.
Oh, you did bring it up.
I brought it up, but
you wanted more questions about it?
Yeah, I remember seeing it for the first time at the Arclight in L.A., and it was so jarring to see a penis that much in a mainstream movie, in like a movie filled with people. I mean, I see a lot of penises in other movies. But I was... I don't know why... it comes up a lot. I just sat at a table...
Table.
I was just at a dinner party, a tea party, with some other cast members of The Watchmen. Jesus. I was just in Indianapolis, and I was my friend Malin Ackerman. Name drop. Was
was like, hey, come sit with us at this. And it was all the Watchmen and Watchwomen. Patrick Wilson and Carla Gugino and everyone from that movie was there except for Billy. Huh. And I remember at one point Billy's blue penis in that movie came up and we were talking about it, like laughing about it. And I wish now I had asked him more about that. And also the whole process of, because I love that movie, the whole process of capturing, you know, that stop motion, what that experience must have been like. Mm-hmm. For an actor like Billy, who's like, you know, that theater actor who is, I imagine that must have been a very strange.
That's a cool movie.
Thing for, it is
that cool. Opening sequence of the movie is so cool.
Yeah, the Bob Dylan song.
Yes, right. Queen. It's cool. Yeah, you talked about handkerchiefs.
Yes.
And I agree with you. I think they're really gross. But I think his reason for using one is couldn't have been.
I knew you'd like that.
Sweeter and more special.
I know.
Our father had one growing up. I remember our grandfather.
He had a bunch.
Had
he had a whole drawer.
It was
of
like
them.
A man thing to have.
Yeah,
everyone had handkerchiefs.
Yeah, it's true.
That's and true. At the time, it didn't strike me how gross it was to just keep recycling the same piece of material.
I know, but it's also
but now
good.
The thought of it is so gross to me.
It is, but it's good for the environment. And yeah, now it occurs sure. to me that Colin Hanks has a charity. He started a line of handkerchiefs called Hanks Kerchiefs, which you know already I love because I love a good pun. Mm-hmm. But that might be worth looking into for Damien. I think I'm going to get him some Hanks Kerchiefs for Christmas.
If there was a way, if someone could develop the technology where handkerchiefs are still handkerchiefs, but in a less gross way. You know, if there was some way
maybe
of
Colin
absorbing
yeah.
the mucus.
If
in
you
a way
make it with like the Saks material, the Saks underwear material, the micro wicking stuff.
Oh, we should stop recording. This is a great business idea. It's a great partnership.
Shit, wait. All right, no one take it. It's ours.
Huh? I love that relationship that he explained with his grandfather and how his grandfather was so uncomfortable in a lot of ways with the idea of going to a play, but yet he went to all of them.
I know. How sweet.
And it was difficult for him to muster a compliment, but just him saying, like, under his breath, oh, good job.
Yeah.
Was, really like, touching. The equivalent of someone who is comfortable talking about theater, like, going on and being so effusive in their praise.
Much more powerful, I think. Much more meaningful. I mean, I've heard so much of, on the other end of the spectrum of, like, oh, this was revelatory. And it changed the way I see the world and the art form of acting. Just to hear a guy, you know, his grandpa just being like, you were pretty good. I mean, that just speaks volumes.
Oh, my God. It's crazy that his dad, about his dad.
I know. I didn't know that. And I brought it up.
Man.
I was since with friends of his, because we have a lot of mutual friends, as discussed. And I mentioned that to them. I said, you know, and they said, oh, yeah. So I guess he's open about it.
Well, yeah. He just talked about it.
I know, publicly. That's true. That's true. Yeah. But he seems like he's so much more. He's like a – that's the interesting thing about – passing down certain things and about acting as therapy, you know. And
right.
And
it struck me that if Billy wasn't an actor.
Yeah, what would have happened?
It's almost as if he had put the charm that he has to nefarious use.
Like his
like
dad.
That's what his dad did. Yeah. His dad, it sounds like he modeled. He's this handsome, charming guy.
By the way, when he said that, when he's like, my dad modeled, it took everything for me to not be like, oh, yeah, obviously. Yeah. Well, look at you. And he mentioned how his grandfather was gorgeous, too.
I don't think
he used the word gorgeous.
Yeah, of course.
So handsome.
But it's like, it just shows you how, you know, easy it is from one generation to the next just based on, like, how you use those powers. Like, his dad sounds like if he had used that charisma
That's
and
true.
Those looks in different ways, he
That's
could have
true.
Easily become some big, you know, like Marlon Brando or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
But instead, he, you know, went down a different road.
That's true.
But there's such a fine line.
It's almost like this, yeah, so then the art becomes salvation.
Also like acting, it's like there's something a little
Connie about
acting.
Yeah, it's
you're fooling people into thinking you're a different person.
Well, that's why
you're tricking them.
That's why that scene. Not to reference a movie I was in, but Galaxy Quest. There's a really poignant scene that Alan Rickman has with Enrico Colantoni, where Enrico, who's playing an alien, who has only seen Alan Rickman on this show that he thinks is real. Alan or Tim, maybe it's Tim Allen. No, it's Tim Allen has to tell Enrico Colantoni that it was fake.
Mm-hmm.
And
that is a good scene.
And these aliens had never heard of acting. It's a really beautiful scene where Rico says, "You deceived us." Oh, it's really, I'm getting chills thinking about it. And Tim Allen is great. It's beautiful.
It is. There's a deceptive element to acting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You should rethink what you're doing with your life, Mick.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Well, I am.
It surprised me that he was a class clown.
Oh, really?
Yeah, only because he's so handsome. And
that's true.
Not to dwell on his looks any more than we already have, way too much of. But class clowns typically aren't, like, the good-looking kids.
That's true.
They're not necessarily not good-looking, but it's weird to have such a handsome class clown, I think.
What do you mean? I was the class clown.
Oh, right.
What are you saying?
Well, I always thought you were the exception.
Yeah.
But I guess he's the exception.
No, he's funny, and he's like rambunctious, and yeah, I've just had so many fun times with him.
I like the Boy Scout chat. He was very curious what rank you got to.
Yeah. Christian, well, you want to say this. You want me to tee you up for it? Because you don't want to just brag and say you're an Eagle Scout.
No, I'm Christian's very comfortable Scout. Bragging because I can brag because I think he's so impressive in so many ways.
That's one of the only things you have on him?
Exactly. So I'm comfortable saying, oh, I have one thing on that guy. I'm like maybe 2 inches taller than him.
That's true.
And I'm an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
But that's it.
I'm not saying anything.
I have it on you too. Fuck you.
Yeah, I know. Eagle Scout, what was your project again?
I restored the teacher's lounge of my elementary school.
Right. That's right. Oh, God. That underprivileged school that
here
you
we
went
go.
To.
Wow. Yeah. You've never gotten over it.
That was necessary. That was so good for humanity.
What was your project?
Well, it was going to be this, I think, is better than yours, was going to bring the Bluebird, because the Bluebird had left Connecticut. They were trying to – they were doing this – project
that is cool
and the Bluebird back
and it would have been better than mine if you had done it.
I know,
but if
I had
you
all these
do it, it's not better.
Oh, I remember I had all these designs for Bluebird boxes and like how to set them up. You have to like space them a certain distance apart and you have to put them on poles. I thought you're gonna make fun of me for saying
well
you had to put them on poles. It was I do regret not doing
what
it.
What could have been,
and Pa really wanted us to me to get it, but I was thinking about how cool it was that our dad, I mean, we've talked about this. It's Pop, if you're listening, we just love that he came on all those trips.
Yeah.
He was such a present father. And, when Billy was talking about his own dad and how, you know, his dad's struggles and how I started feeling really like,
nostalgic. Yeah. He was very
grateful to have a father who was there.
Of course. You sort of take that for granted, you don't realize until you hear stories of other people who didn't have that. It's not until then that you realize that, it's not just like normal what we experience.
I know.
You know,
really
lucky. We were really lucky.
Even if anything, at the time, it was like, dad's coming. You know, I never felt that, but like, I also I didn't fully appreciate that he was so present.
Sure. Well, you appreciate it now.
Yeah.
you made a segue from him talking about being at the arcade, getting in trouble for being at the arcade. Mm-hmm. When he was supposed to be at Boy Scout meeting, and then he started talking about Arcadia, play, and you were and I thought, oh my God, that Arcadia segue was so impressive, and then you announced how impressive it was, and I was like, ugh. It was so impressive until you said that.
I know.
You just couldn't let it go.
I had to be celebrated. I want Billy's approval too. That's why I was like, that compliment he paid me when I was younger meant so much, like to get that guy's approval.
He seems to really love acting.
He's like, a true actor, like Sam.
Yeah. He seems very passionate about the work itself.
I can't imagine him doing anything else. And he would probably be really good at other things.
Right.
But I can't imagine it.
He's very bright. Yeah. I'm sure he could do a lot of things, but, he's very passionate about acting, but he's also very principled, I think, about selling himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how he was talking about – I thought that was really impressive how –
Oh, me too.
His relationship with
– press and all that.
Yeah, like the promotional element of a project. Just really principled.
Yeah.
How he doesn't want to be seen as – it's like I've already done the work. Like I've – the job was – to play this
role. Exactly. It makes so much sense.
And now I don't want this movie studio to use me to sell their movie.
To make my life, my personal life, to expose it
to the world.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm sure his reticence to to open himself up like that contributed to him, you know, maybe not becoming Brad Pitt or someone, you know.
Well, and that's another thing we don't really get into, because that was part of the narrative about him, about Billy, is that he had this, we mentioned Almost Famous a few times, and like that was, ironically, that was the movie that was supposed to make him famous. And I don't know if the movie didn't perform. I don't know why it didn't. People have attributed his reticence to do press and stuff to his lack of fame, I guess. But I think it's only served him in the long run. I think if he had become – lived up to whatever those expectations were, where do you go from there? I mean, then it becomes you're living – it's harder to – like he says, slip in and out of these other characters. And Billy's work is so – I hate this term, but so chameleon-like. I mean, his he's able to go between all these different tones and different worlds, and he's able to play so many different parts.
That's interesting. I like your internal fart at the end.
well, not just now.
It reminded me of it, that you had one with him at the end of the interview. And but I thought it was a respectful, because the reason it happened was because you sat on it and you prevented a fart from coming out.
Right, right. Respect.
And that shows your respect for him.
Yes, yeah.
I wish you had a little more respect for me.
I paid you crude up respect?
Oh, God.
Well, like,
I'm an Eagle Scout, remember?
You know, it's funny when you hear that people's that noise come from people.
Bam.
And like everyone, you know, you can relate to that. It's like a pinball. It's like a fart that's pinballing around your body. But what's the word for it? Because it is technically a – I think we've talked about this on this show, actually.
Too much, maybe. An internal fart.
An IF? I mean, shouldn't there be a word for that instead of internal
A gas
fart?
Bubble, I think people say. Yeah. Anyway, that's the show. Anyway. should we read a letter?
Yeah. Okay. This is a letter from – shaking. Too much coffee. This is from Margaret C., and the subject is Roadkill Taxidermist. Hey, Justin, Christian, and everyone else that makes this show possible. Well, that's nice. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Huh. I started religiously listening to your show when there were some episodes that shouted out my hometown area. Insert local Berkshire County phrases to show pride. I wanted to share one of the things that brings me the joy in this short life. That thing is roadkill taxidermy, whoa, and bone collection. At Peg – and she leaves an Instagram account. At Peg a Bone Studio. Going to check it out. I got into the art form when I was driving by a dead animal on the way to a friend's house. It was a perfectly preserved fox on the side of the road. No blood or guts to stain the pelt. Just a little angel fox taking a dirt nap. Jesus. To think of this pristine creature rotting, its beauty leaking away as the days go by, was painful. Oh my God. Call it morbid curiosity, but at that point I knew I had to understand animal preservation. Fast forward to 5 years later, I now proudly house 2,000 plus dermested beetles in my kitchen. I feed them with the dead animals I keep in an industrial freezer in my basement. Oh my God, you sound right up my alley. Don't worry, I only work with animals that met their fate in accidental ways. Okay. I do not work with anything that has been killed for sport. It's also worth noting that I come from a veterinary background, so I'm no stranger to dead animals. Now, being a roadkill revivalist isn't all guts and glamour. There have been a lot of ups and downs along the way. Once my beetles got mites. Yes, my bugs got bugs. And I lost my whole colony. Another time, my entire inventory was trashed when my freezer unthawed during a lightning storm. Sometimes life just gets in the way. But I still love spending time in my studio and working on making death beautiful. I have received a lot of incredible support from friends, family, and even strangers on taking my art seriously. The biggest compliments I receive are when someone asks me to work on a beloved pet once they pass. I hope you enjoy learning about how I make the most out of my life, coming face to face with mortality and giving life after death. If you and the listeners are still here and feeling brave, follow me on Instagram. Again, it's at Pegabone Studio. Have a great show and rest of the year with respect. Maggie C. Okay. And then she says, I put a asterisk up there to the beetles so I can explain what they are. They are beetles that eat decaying matter, flesh, and clean bones. It's a better way to clean the bones, in my opinion. It helps me forego having to use caustic chemicals that aren't good for me or the environment to strip the bones. Don't worry, the beetles are harmless if you are alive and tend to be quite timid. Interesting. So, wow. That's cool. Cool.
Something I'm not going to get into, but
no, I can safely
cool.
say.
It's, I can safely say, but it's cool that she does that.
Yeah, it is, and I never thought of it that way to as a way to preserve death,
life
rather. Sorry.
Well, that's the show.
That's interesting.
Thanks for writing in. If you guys want to write in, our email address is lifeisshort@wondery.com, and
thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening
And
for writing in. And if you don't write in, that's cool too. If you just listen, that's great.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-shaboom.
Life is Short is hosted by me, Justin Long. It's produced by Christian Long and Megan Monaco. Senior producer is Michelle Mish-Lanz.
Audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez.
And the executive producers are Marshall Louis and Hernan Lopez for Wondery. And you all make the show possible because you're actually listening to it. So we thank you so much for that. And have a great week.
You think it's what?
Kind of like stealing.
Well, or it's paying homage. They're continuing their music. I mean, think about that. Bach's music gets played everywhere. Mozart's been getting played for centuries.
Well,
when these guys are dead, hopefully other people will play.
Well, that's true. But do they kind of look like them and dress like them? And
listen. That's just fun.
If you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding. How can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat?
Is that what they're saying?
Yeah. And the audience loves it.
That's pretty funny. The pudding.
Don't. If you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding.
That's such a weird way to end a song.
It's so funny.
Wait, what song is this? Oh, I love this song.
Mother, do you trust the government?
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Life is Short ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.